There was once a highway that never really lived up to its potential. So now an artist is turning it into a pop-up forest.
The juxtaposition of all of this concrete with something that is so soft and welcoming and gentle, that was really something that people connected with.
This week on the Allegheny Front, a Rust Belt city bets on investing in more green space. Plus, climate change is already causing flooding in some cities and uncovering racial and economic disparities.
This is a huge disease that's ruining our homes and really demoralizing as a homeowner.
And a work of art in Pittsburgh is inspiring some to reconsider urban wildlife.
This piece is so stinking cute. I just smile.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. A new national database compiled by the Environmental Working Group shines a light on water quality issues around the U.S. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports the tool allows consumers to search by zip code or their local water utility name and aggregates information from nearly 50,000 public systems.
The organization's findings show U.S. water systems are contaminated by 256 different chemicals. 81% of all water systems detected chemicals linked to cancer, and 19,000 systems detected lead levels that could be harmful to infants. EWG senior scientist David Andrews says the Environmental Protection Agency has not added a new chemical to its list of regulated contaminants in 20 years. So he says people shouldn't think their water is problem-free just because it gets a passing grade from regulators.
We're really hopeful that consumers and Americans will find this useful and highlight the fact that legal doesn't necessarily mean safe.
Late last year, the EPA warned Pennsylvania it was failing to properly enforce safe drinking water standards due to a lack of staff and funding at the State Department of Environmental Protection. In response, the agency says it will hike fees on public water systems. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania.
A few years ago, drinking water in Toledo, Ohio was contaminated, not by industrial chemicals, but algae blooms. In 2014, nearly 500,000 people were told to avoid their tap water for 3 days because it was contaminated with a toxin in the blooms called microcystin. Exposure to it is known to cause flu-like symptoms, vomiting, diarrhea, and nausea. The first signs of summer algae blooms were spotted this month on Western Lake Erie. And more people want to know whether microcystin from those blooms is making them sick. Tom Henry is a reporter at the Toledo Blade newspaper and covers Lake Erie and other environmental issues. He says that during the algae scare a few years ago, doctors were unable to attribute symptoms to microcystin because there's no test for it.
If you present yourself at a hospital, the medical community doesn't have an accepted protocol for diagnosing this. They understand what the symptoms are, but there's not a specific way of saying yes or no. Is it because you've been exposed to algal toxins?
Experts at the University of Toledo Medical Center, Wayne State University, and the Centers for Disease Control are working to develop a test to diagnose people exposed to algal toxins. They call it a critical step in combating what's really a global problem. Henry says they also want to know if there are long-term health effects from this type of water contamination.
They really want to start studying what are the potential low-level exposure effects if people are exposed to low levels of microcystin in their water over 30 to 40 years.
The threat from microcystin is one reason experts are urging Congress to continue funding for Great Lakes programs. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant has a longer conversation with the Toledo Blade's Tom Henry about the Great Lakes on our podcast, Trump on Earth. That's at trumponearth.org or wherever you listen to your podcasts. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Scientists have linked the thick green slime from algae blooms on Lake Erie to global warming. And according to the US EPA, the blooms could be even worse in the coming years. We know climate change isn't going to affect everyone the same way. In other places, there are islands that will disappear. Parts of the world could spend years in drought. Wealthier nations might be able to prepare, while poorer ones might get hit hardest. But you don't have to travel halfway around the world to see this disparity. Sometimes you just have to take a bus ride across town. Reporter Shannon Heffernan did this in Chicago for WBEZ's Heat of the Moment series. Here's her story.
Cheryl Watson still lives in the home where she grew up, and she doesn't want to leave. It's in the Chatham neighborhood, a place known as the Jewel of the South Side. And even when Cheryl was a little girl back in the 1950s, something about this place felt special to her. It was full of black-owned businesses and perfectly manicured lawns.
And everyone knew each other for miles around because the churches were teeming with residents. All the kids played in the park together. So there was that greater family feeling.
But in a segregated city like Chicago, Chatham had to fight hard to get what it needed. Neighbors lobbied the city for better schools and fixed up streets. Even buying a house here was a fight. It was so difficult to get a loan as a black man that Cheryl's dad had to have a white guy sign all the mortgage papers. Perhaps because everything was so hard won, people took a lot of pride in their homes, and still do. Before Cheryl's dad passed away, he asked her to keep the house in the family.
And so this is something I would really, really, really like to hold on to for the rest of my life.
But holding on to her home may not be easy. The Chatham neighborhood is, in a way, in the middle of a climate change disaster. It's not the kind of disaster you normally think of. There's no huge single event with TV cameras and Red Cross campaigns. It's something less visible, more every day. To understand the rest of the story, we have to talk here about urban flooding. Over the years, cities everywhere have added more pavement, parking lots, streets. That means when it rains, there's less dirt to absorb it. The water doesn't have anywhere to go, so it seeps into people's foundations. Climate change research tells us that heavy rain is becoming more common in Chicago. But Cheryl already knew that. You can actually see how the watermarks in her basement have gotten higher over time.
And no one really can tell you how this can be resolved.
The city gets more calls about flooding in Chatham and its surrounding areas than anywhere else in the entire city. But Cheryl still felt like she was alone. After all, this was a disaster that was happening inside houses, away from public view. She tried to talk to her neighbors about it. She brought a bunch of pamphlets and information to a block club meeting. But she says everyone just had this deer-in-the-headlights look on their face.
It was kind of that look like, oh, she knows our secret.
Cheryl says people were scared that if word got out about flooding, their home value would drop. Plus, it can be really embarrassing. All that rainwater also gets into the sewage system, gets mixed up with all that nasty stuff. During a heavy rain, the sewage system can get overwhelmed. And then sewage backs up into people's homes. Lori Burns lives about 5 blocks away from Cheryl. She's a little bit younger, and she inherited her home from her grandparents. In 2008, there were 2 back-to-back storms. Lori remembers seeing it pouring down and thinking she better get home. When she did, she found her house was filling with sewage.
And it's all coming up through the toilet, through the drains in the floor in the laundry room, and wherever else.
The smell was awful. Her college papers, childhood keepsakes, they were all soaked in sewage water. Lori has a calm, matter-of-fact demeanor. She's a problem solver and went right into action, called up her brother. It wasn't the first time it had happened, so they knew what to do. Together, they spent days scrubbing the whole place with bleach and throwing stuff out.
I can't even really describe it other than to say disgusted and really angry and really defeated.
She remembers going to a nearby Target and seeing all these people stocking up on mops and plastic gloves. People in the neighborhood bought hip waders, not to fish, but to go into their own homes. Lori remembers being in the checkout line and realizing, oh, it's not just her. This is a thing in Chatham.
And it's like, wow, this is the future? That we're having these storms where there's more than 2 inches of rain or 3 inches that fall within an hour or something like that?
This is what climate change will look like for most of us. It will be the mundane things, the stuff you have to call the city about. It won't be sudden or flashy, not tsunamis or tidal waves, but creep up, like water from a basement. Over the next few years, Lori started looking around for solutions. One night, she landed on this website for floodproofing her home.
And there was this thing, the flyer for the Gross Gathering.
It was literally called the Gross Gathering.
Because it's gross to have raw sewage in your basement. Hello. So I'm like, okay, well, I don't care where this is, I'm going.
The meeting was on the north side, run by this group called Center for Neighborhood Technology. There weren't many African-American people at the meeting. People were from north side areas, places like Albany Park. Lori noticed that, took note that she was probably the only person there from her neighborhood, even though it's in one of the most regularly flooded areas in Chicago.
I determined then whatever they were getting, we were going to get. And soon after that, I saw online, like on a Sunday night, and I just came across this thing. And it was a press release saying that Albany Park area, hard hit by flooding, and there's like many, many millions of dollars that the city came up with in order to make sure that something big, some big project can start happening there to make sure that they don't ever suffer from this kind of flooding again. I was pissed.
Lori thought the Albany Park neighborhood deserved all the help it could get. She was just mad that Chatham wasn't getting the same kind of attention from the city. A spokesperson from the city of Chicago says it has updated pipes and infrastructure in Chatham. And comparing Albany Park and Chatham is unfair. Albany Park is near a river, so a different problem than Chatham, which is in a really low-lying part of Chicago. But still, in the same way that most climate change problems will be everyday and mundane, the struggle to find solutions will be that way too. It won't be all about calling in the National Guard. It will be about city services, aldermen, sewers. And the same problems we complain about with city services, those are the things Lori and her neighbors believe they will be up against when it comes to climate change fixes.
And there is this notion or assumption, whatever you want to call it, that these sides of the city don't get the same services or the same attention that, say, the north side or the northwest sides of the city do.
And so Lori took things into her own hands. She reached out to the Center for Neighborhood Technology, that organization that held the meeting on the north side. And together they started working on flooding problems in Chatham. They gathered data and realized that Chatham had more insurance claims for flooding than anywhere else in the city. That sounds like bad news, but it was also kind of comforting for Lori, because it was like this thing she thought was happening, now she had tangible proof.
Because we weren't really understanding how endemic the problem was or how expansive it was, there wasn't this groundswell of activity to say, hey, this is a huge disease that we have that's ruining our homes, diminishing home values, and really demoralizing as a homeowner.
Armed with this information, Lori and CNT have started organizing neighbors, people like Cheryl, the woman we heard at the top of this story. CNT also helped Lori get a special thing called a backup valve installed. They can be really expensive, and a lot of people can't afford them. Lori says it's worked really well. But the sewage she's keeping out of her home, it didn't disappear. It's just flowing down the line to her neighbor's homes.
Fine, you protect your home, but you're screwing your neighbor. So it doesn't solve the problem, it just solves the problem for me.
Of course, there's an obvious way people could handle this. They could just move, change neighborhoods. But not everyone has the cash to do that, and it's hard to sell a house with flooding problems. And besides, a lot of people are like Lori. They don't like passing a problem down the line. They want it actually solved. And so, Lori will be out there knocking on doors and calling the city. She knows she can't change the weather, but she can make sure Chatham is ready for it. Shannon Heffernan, WBEZ.
Some cities are reconsidering their outdated infrastructure and pavement.
Behold the grandeur. Your radio audience can't see it right now, but we're standing over a big old highway.
They're imagining fewer cars and more trees. That's coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay tuned. A raccoon in or near a dumpster is not so unusual. But a huge raccoon sculpture made out of recycled trash that might have ended up in a dumpster, that's something else.
The feet of this piece is so stinking cute, I can't even stand it. Like, every time I look at it, I just smile. It's like two little, like, kid cars, like, converted into, like, these little raccoon toes and everything. It's just adorable.
That's right. The raccoon has plastic bubble eyes and peers at onlookers from an outside wall at Construction Junction, a nonprofit in Pittsburgh where you can donate and buy recycled building materials. Its back paw, made from a purple plastic toy car, dangles playfully from above the warehouse doors. Melissa Mongelli is general manager and chief operating officer at Construction Junction.
It really speaks to, like, what Construction Junction is all about. It's about reuse. It's taking something that was just going to be thrown away and just making it new again and just making it into a beautiful piece of art. Like, I literally get choked up when I see it. It's just because it's so beautiful.
The piece was built here recently by well-known Portuguese street artist Bordalo Segundo as part of his Trash Animals series.
He sees animals as the victims of human action and human pollution in particular.
That's Rebecca Reed from Scrap the Trap, a group that advocates for more humane treatment of urban wildlife. They commissioned the artist to come to Pittsburgh and create the piece.
The raccoon is kind of hanging on to the building.
Yeah, well, actually, if you'll see, if you look, there's a branch coming up the middle there, and the raccoon is hanging upside down. The baby raccoon head, that is mainly made out of car parts that were donated by various car recycling yards in the area. So it's fenders and plastic fuel tanks and bits of door panel and things like that. Here's a message of disposability, which I think really fits with what we as Scrap the Trap are trying to do. You know, the disposability of these plastic items that are shipped from the other side of the world and we use them for a year and then throw them out. And also the disposability of these animals, this wildlife, these animals that live in our backyards, and yet we treat them in a very disposable manner.
Well, so talk a little bit about what your organization does and what you want to highlight as a result of this piece.
We would like the city to completely revise its policy towards wildlife in such a way that all residents are getting genuine assistance for long-term solutions to dealing with any wildlife conflicts that they may have, and that the trapping and involvement by animal control in wildlife issues is restricted to emergencies only.
So right now, residents can call the city and have a raccoon or a groundhog trapped.
Yeah, they call in the case of the city traps, they put down a $40 deposit that is returned to them when the trap is returned. They set the trap, and once the animal is trapped, then animal control comes and picks it up.
The Pennsylvania Game Commission requires the city of Pittsburgh and companies with permits to trap what they call nuisance wildlife to euthanize any trapped raccoons, groundhogs, and skunks because they're disease vectors. They can carry the rabies virus. But Reed, who's volunteered in wildlife rehabilitation, doesn't think that's a good idea.
Trapping animals constantly out of an environment like Pittsburgh, which is such a green city with its rivers and parks and woodlands and lots of little areas that are almost rural, if you keep trapping animals out of an environment like that, all you're doing is creating a turnover which vastly increases the risk of disease eventually entering an area. So it's just a very irrational system that is so deep-rooted in this city. Yes, we want to avoid situations where there are too many of a specific species in a given area. There are blight areas in Pittsburgh that where there are issues that they need to be dealt with. Yes, we agree. But just going in and trapping animals is not the way to deal with it. We need to have a dialogue about if there are problems with wildlife in specific areas, what is causing those problems.
So what are the alternatives? What do you tell people?
Well, I mean, the first thing I ask people, if they say they are having a raccoon or a groundhog problem, I ask them to describe the immediate area, because raccoons in particular are not going to hang out in your yard because they like your porch swing. They're hanging out in your yard because there's something there that they like. You know, and I've had people tell me, oh, no, there's nothing on my porch. And then they'll finally tell me, well, all that's there is the recycling. Well, yeah, they like that. Cans of things that you probably didn't wash out very well. You know, like, you've got to figure out what is bringing these animals into your yard.
And what about animals that try to get inside of your house?
Well, I'm actually dealing with a situation. I'm helping a neighbor with that right now. I mean, harassment methods that you can use to evict, literally evict the animal from the home. You can use a one-way door, which is a little bit like the traps they use, but you just sort of fix it onto the hole they're getting into. And as long as you're sure there's no small babies that are going to get left behind, you have to check that before. Basically, they can get out, but they can't get in again. But that is one of the problems we have with the city trapping too, is that you have people that have access points in their homes who are continually trapping the animals, and then more come in and more come in, and we're not fixing the problem.
Reed says trapping and releasing non-rabies vector species like possums doesn't really work either. Often their young are left behind and don't survive. Or in the case of squirrels, they're very territorial and don't do well in new environments.
My experience with the residents we've interacted with has been that the vast majority of people are very reasonable. Sometimes they're afraid when you explain things to them and you tell them why it's not a good idea to move animals. Most people do care. They don't want the animals to die. They don't want something bad to happen to them. They're just frightened and they want their particular issue to be resolved. We totally acknowledge that people on a day-to-day basis in Pittsburgh are encountering conflicts with raccoons. I'm saying they're not just those bad creatures you're perceiving. This is the other side that I'd like us to think of. You know, like, let's have these animals in our environment at a distance in a safe way. Let's find out how to keep them at a distance and to coexist with them peacefully. And if this piece of art can even trigger people starting to think about it, then I think that we have achieved what we wanted here.
You can see a photo of Bordallo's trash art raccoon looking at you with its big dark eyes at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Well, we might not know what the population of raccoons is in the city, but Pittsburgh, like other Rust Belt towns, is still shrinking when it comes to its population of people. In one Ohio city, they've lost so many, they're shutting down a highway. But the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that something new is being constructed there, at least temporarily, that's giving people hope for the future of its downtown.
Kahakuta Chief wants more places around Akron, Ohio for people to gather, to just hang around. Kahakuta Chief is program director at the Knight Foundation here, and to show me what he means, we walk onto a newly renovated pedestrian bridge.
Behold the grandeur. Your radio audience can't see it right now, but we're standing over a big old highway.
And this highway, a section of Ohio State Route 59 known as the Inner Belt, is empty. It's actually being removed.
A highway that was intended to carry about 115,000 cars a day only carried about 15,000 cars a day because it didn't actually bisect downtown. It dead ends into a traffic light. We can see just ahead of us here. And it's been this Great Wall of China that's pinned in downtown for about 40 years.
Kahakuta Chief says the highway's construction in the 1970s created a barrier between the largely African-American neighborhoods of West Akron and the city center, creating social and economic rifts that still affect the city.
The development of those neighborhoods took a big hit because of the highway cutting it off from the downtown.
Shutting down the Inner Belt will open up more than 30 acres of prime real estate to try something new. And now the Knight Foundation is working with Akron on a vision for the site.
How do we make this a place for people again rather than just cars?
This is part of their Knight Cities Challenge to invest in communities to help them become more successful. The foundation's reimagining of this space is being led by a San Francisco-based artist. In this video from 2015, when the highway was still open to traffic, the artist, Hunter Franks, hosted a big community meal.
So we're here in beautiful Akron, Ohio, at the site of 500 Plates.
He got the state to close Route 59 for a few hours to set up a really long table, big enough for 500 people. right on the highway.
And we're coming here today to share a meal. We're having 500 people from every neighborhood in Akron, Ohio, come together, sit next to their neighbors, and also to imagine what this Interbelt Freeway could be used for in the future.
Speaking more recently by Skype with Hunter Franks, he says people at that dinner talked and wrote down what they might like to see on the site. And he says people really seem to want more public space and more green space.
I think the juxtaposition of this freeway and all of this concrete with something that is so soft and welcoming and gentle to people in a park or whatever the green space may end up looking like, that was really something that people connected with.
The Knight Foundation has given Franks a grant to create something of a pop-up forest. For a few months, starting next spring, they'll bring in temporary trees and plants, add seating, and offer programming, things like concerts, a farmer's market, and movie screenings. Repurposing old infrastructure isn't unique to Akron.
Yeah, this is a phenomenon that's definitely happening across the country and internationally as well.
That's Joshua Newell. He's an assistant professor at the School for Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan. He says the High Line in New York City is the poster child for this kind of infrastructure redevelopment. It used to be an above-ground rail line and was converted into an elevated park and walkway through Lower Manhattan.
And now it's a huge success. It's a major tourist attraction in Manhattan. And it brings people from all over the world to walk along the High Line.
But critics say property values and rents near the High Line have skyrocketed, pushing out local businesses and lower-income residents.
There is a very real danger of gentrification, of increasing property values around these very attractive, often green spaces in the city. And so that has to be a continual effort by city officials and community to guard against.
In Akron's quiet downtown, where few people are walking around on this hot summer day, the Knight Foundation's Kyle Kutuchief says gentrification is less of a concern. He says many work in the city's high-rises, but he wants to see them on the streets.
You know, that the people don't just sit in their cubicles and have Jimmy John's delivered and get back in the car and go home, that there's this, you know, let's go meet for breakfast, let's go walk to the food trucks and grab lunch, and it's just having that rhythm of life and activity and interest in the city.
Kutuchief hopes the pop-up forest will bring people together and spark some creativity for what's next in Akron. It could also help fuel similar projects in cities around the country. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Thanks for listening to this week's Allegheny Front. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. And don't forget about our podcast, Trump on Earth. You can find it at trumponearth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsoppel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy. Heat of the Moment is funded by the Joyce Foundation, working to improve quality of life, promote community vitality, and achieve a fair society. The Joyce Foundation at joycefdn.org.